Imam Ali alayhi salam lived a life in which he was the embodiment of social justice. Now, when we see before Imam Ali reached to the caliphate, the khalifa of the Muslims, even during his life before this era, he emphasized and he worked on social justice. Of course, he always tried to help the poor. He tried to empower the downtrodden. And of course, he protected the oppressed. When it comes to social justice and being fair and equitable, especially in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, during the era of the Khilafah, when he was the caliph of the Muslims, we find that the way that he distributed the Baytul Mal, he distributed the funds of the public treasury, it was always in accordance to fairness and true justice. Now, unfortunately, the previous caliphs, the first three caliphs, and especially the third caliph, Usman, we find that the distribution of the Baytul Mal, the distribution of the public treasury, was done in an unjust manner. And this is something that is reflected in the history books, and it is a fact when we look into the history of the Muslims. And so when it came time to Imam Ali alayhi salam's caliphate, we find, of course, that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, he distributed this Baytul Mal in a just manner. Unlike the previous caliphs of the Muslims, the first three caliphs, who distributed the public treasury and the Baytul Mal based upon, for example, tribal alliances or friendships or different kinds of ulterior motives, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he actually distributed the Baytul Mal in an equitable and just manner. No longer was an Arab better than a non-Arab. No longer was a free person better than an enslaved person. And no longer was a man better than a woman, a friend better than an enemy, and so forth. It's actually quite interesting, but we see that even after the battle that Imam Ali had with the Khawarij, and the Khawarij opposed Imam Ali alayhi salam to an extent where they were killing the companions and even the women folk of the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, still the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, did not stop the public funding and the Baytul Mal from reaching the families of the Khawarij. In today's day and age, of course, social justice being something that is direly in need. We see a world almost completely filled up with social injustice. There is discrimination wherever we see. There is the discrimination between black and white, between local and foreigner, even between Arab and non-Arab, between English speaker and a non-English speaker, and so forth, between man and woman, of course. And in this day and age, truly, we can definitely benefit from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam when it comes to social justice, and to show us that all are equal before the eyes of Allah. The only difference is that he and she who has more taqwa, more God consciousness, more piety, is more favorable and better in the eyes of Allah. A very beautiful and profound lesson regarding social justice brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Ziyara بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارعا
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits a supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seek redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Let me touch briefly the history. As you know, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, when they realized that they made mistakes, the people went to his house after the third Khalifa was tragically killed. People ganged up on him and killed him. It's a tragic scenario when anyone is killed. I don't care who it is. And they go to the house of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they said, we acknowledge. They pulled him out of his house. They dragged him. Literally, they were so excited that you have to take that position that God has conferred upon you. For we have realized that the Muslim ummah has degraded in so many ways. And you find Imam Ali alayhi salam accepts that with conditions. He said, you will obey me the way Allah has commanded, wa ulil amri minkum. They agreed. Sadly, when he comes into power, many forces had already taken their bases in deep formations. One being Muawiyah. Muawiyah, for 30 years plus, had been establishing himself and taking from the public treasury to build a vast empire. History a little bit, brothers and sisters. The Byzantine Empire, which is Syria today, that empire today, when it fell from the Christian hands to the Muslims, the first governor was Muawiyah's brother, who died very shortly before. And then right after that, as you know, Muawiyah takes governorship and never leaves it till his death. Never leaves that leadership. And remember, the people of Byzantium, who were Syrians of the time, had not seen Ahlul Bayt. It was foreign to them. They were Christians. And many had converted to Islam, either through trade or whatever means, but they were not aware of the true power of Ahlul Bayt. Thus, Muawiyah systematically kept them in the dark and created all kinds of false ideas against Ahlul Bayt, which culminates in Ashura, that after Imam Hussein alayhi salam is martyred, when Imam Zainul Abidin and Zainab alayhi salam enter the city of Sham, which is known as Syria, when they enter it, people were mocking at them, mocking them that it's good God has killed you, or you recalcitrant people who are disobeying the caliph of the time. Not realizing that the ones that they killed were the blood and the Prophet himself. Not realizing that. And that is why the power of the revolution of Karbala was so strong, that when Imam Zainul Abidin enters the city of Sham and Imam Zainul Abidin climbs the pulpit, for the first time he addresses himself as to who he really is, the people of Syria begin to realize what a mistake they have made. Understand, this was Muawiyah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Ever since Russia's special operation in Ukraine started, Western countries, especially the United States, have sent billions of dollars worth of weapons and military equipment to Ukraine to attempt to help the country against Russia's operation. Moscow has repeatedly warned Washington and its allies against their arms supplies to Kiev, which the Kremlin says contributes to further escalating the conflict. Another important point is that military officials of these countries that are supporting Ukraine have warned that if the West continues to provide excessive arms to Ukraine, their strategic arms stockpiles will be reduced severely. We've taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has more details. In the US weapons industry, the normal production level for artillery rounds for the 155mm howitzer, a long-range heavy artillery weapon currently used on the battlefields of Ukraine, is about 30,000 rounds per year in peacetime. The Ukrainian soldiers fighting Russian forces go through that amount in roughly 2 weeks. That's according to Dave DeRoche, an associate professor and senior military fellow at the U.S. National Defense University. And DeRoche is worried. Dave DeRoche says, "I'm greatly concerned. Unless we have new production, which takes months to ramp up, we're not going to have the ability to supply the Ukrainians." Europe is running low too. Josep Borrell, the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, said recently, "The military stocks of most European NATO member states have been, I wouldn't say exhausted, but depleted in a high proportion, because we have been providing a lot of capacity to the Ukrainians." NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said a special meeting of the alliance's arms directors recently to discuss ways to refill member nations' weapons stockpiles. Military analysts point to a root issue. Western nations have been producing arms at much smaller volumes during peacetime, with governments opting to slim down very expensive manufacturing and only producing weapons as needed. Some of the weapons that are running low are no longer being produced, and highly skilled labor and experience are required for their production. Things that have been in short supply across the United States manufacturing sector for many years. The U.S. has been by far the largest supplier of military aid to Ukraine in its war with Russia, providing billions of dollars worth of weapons to date since Moscow started its special operation in Ukraine last February. Several of the American-made weapons that have been game-changers for the Ukrainians, particularly the 155mm howitzers and long-range heavy artillery like the Lockheed Martin-made HIMARS or high-mobility artillery rocket system. The U.S. has essentially run out of the 155mm howitzers to give to the Ukrainian side. To send any more, it would have to dip into its own stocks of reserves for U.S. military units that use them for training and readiness. What this means for Ukrainian military is that some of their most crucial battlefield equipment, like the 155mm howitzers, is having to be replaced with older and less optimum weaponry, like the 105mm howitzer, which has a smaller payload and a shorter range. Other weapons Ukraine relies on that are now classified as limited in the US inventory include HIMARS, or High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, and HIMARS launchers, Javelin missiles, Stinger missiles, the M777 howitzer, and the 155mm howitzer ammunition. The British newspaper The Financial Times has more for us. Persistent shortages of parts and personnel will continue to dog the Pentagon's top four defense contractors over the next 2 years, as they currently deal with orders related to Washington's ongoing security aid to Kiev amid Russia's ongoing special military operation in Ukraine. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon Technologies have been grappling with snarled supplies since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, something that is currently being worsened by widespread cost inflation. The factors are expected to slow down production rates, damage revenues, and prompt outright losses within the defense contractors. Parts and labor shortages rode roughshod over Boeing's defense business, with the company reporting $2.8 billion in losses in the third quarter of this year. Boeing chief executive Dave Calhoun said that in a supply-constrained world, his company doesn't push the system too fast, adding, "We slow down when we have to, and we try not to compound our problems." According to a new opinion poll, The remarks come against the backdrop of the White House's current security assistance to Ukraine authorities, an issue that has split the American public. The survey conducted by Convention of States Action, along with Trafalgar Group, revealed that 40.3% of respondents call for sending Ukraine weapons and money, while 30.5% support Kiev being provided with weapons but with no money. 24.9% of those who took part in the survey believed that Washington should send Kiev nothing at all. Commenting on the results of the opinion poll, Mark Meckler, president of the Convention of States Action, said, "American voters believe the U.S. is shouldering the burden of supporting Ukraine and seem to be questioning why we are sending billions overseas while our own economy slides deeper into recession. Our nation would benefit from hearing President Joe Biden provide a clearly defined mission and role in the U.S. support to Ukraine, and reassurances that this will not just become a never-ending conflict that drains American resources and skyrockets our nation's debt. Sputnik News Agency has more for us. Former Pentagon official Wesley Hallman said U.S. effort to provide Ukraine with some $17.6 billion worth of military equipment so far is stressing the American defense industry's ability to replenish its stockpiles. Wesley Hallman said, "I was talking to somebody that works at a company that produces some of those munitions that we're depleting because we're giving a lot of it to Ukraine right now. And I said, how long is it going to take you to get your line up and running? They said, it's going to be about 2 years. He added, when I interacted with that executive a couple of weeks ago, that guy was telling me it was going to take 2 years, 2 years until they could get to the rate of production where they could start truly replenishing at the rates needed. That's a long time. Wesley Hallman said the Biden administration's decision to provide Ukraine with some $17.6 billion worth of U.S. military assistance is most definitely straining the U.S. stockpile. He said, my understanding is that it has depleted not just ours, but those of our allies that have ponied up as well. The British, the Poles, the Germans. So yeah, it's affecting all of that. Wesley Hallman believes the depletion of U.S. stockpiles is affecting the U.S. military's readiness for certain operational plans.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasis, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me on this program.
You're welcome. Well, we are happy to have you back in the studio again. Would you shed some light for our dear audience about the meaning of hijab first, before we endeavor this program?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, hijab is an Arabic word meaning barrier or partition. Literally speaking, it means barrier. In Islam, hijab is not about barrier only.
It's so what's it about?
Yeah, it has a broader meaning, and it has something to do with the principles of modesty. And it is, in fact, the principle of modesty itself, because hijab is modesty. So because it includes the individual's behavior as well as the individual's dress.
Dress
and
code?
Of course, dress code. And the hijab is not only for men, for women only. It is both for men and mm-hmm. women. And obviously, it's not only women who are supposed to observe the hijab, and of course, men are also supposed to observe the kind of modesty that are required, that they should. There are some standards of modesty for men also, and these standards must be observed by men as well. Now, the most visible form of hijab, obviously, is the head covering mm-hmm. that many Muslim women wear. And when we talk about hijab, usually people are reminded of the scarf women wear. That is one of the, you know, the most visible form of hijab. And hijab, as I said, goes beyond the headscarf. In a religious context, Actually, hijab is used as an expression to convey an act of covering all parts of the body except the face and the hands. We know very well, because we have of course discussed this issue in the past as well.
Yes,
that women are not are supposed to cover all parts of their body except the hands and except the face and the hands up to the wrists. That's what the Islamic...
But not the feet.
Yeah, of course, the feet should be covered.
Mm-hmm.
The feet should be covered. Not in during prayers, because if you are praying, if a woman is praying, obviously, she is not supposed to cover her feet when there is no one seeing her, when there is no non-mahram or marriageable man nearby to see her without socks without something covering her feet. So covering the feet during prayers is not necessary.
A must, yeah.
But if there is a non-mahram present, then she must observe. She must cover her feet as well.
Yes.
And let me also, just say that hijab actually is not. According to all religious authorities, and of course, according to what we read in books, hijab is not particular to Islam only. Hijab
yes.
existed even in the pre-Islamic era,
yeah.
And it still exists in some religions and some cultures. Of course, the religions have changed over the period of time. They have been tempered with. And that's why many, Christians and many Jews do not observe hijab, while they are supposed, according to their religion, mm-hmm. to observe hijab.
Yes.
Of course, they have their own words. They don't use the term hijab, but
yes.
we use the term hijab. They all probably use some other words,
yes.
which we have no information about, of course.
Right.
Now, when it comes, there is an important question which many people ask, and that's... whether the Quran, for example, whether there is any verse in the Quran which might clearly refer to it or not.
Yes, let me postpone it to after the break, okay?
Sure.
Thank you very much. I'm really sorry for cut you short. We'll actually reach the break, so let's have a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program on English radio.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the important subject of hijab with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you were referring to a question regarding whether there is a verse in the Holy Quran endorsing hijab, right?
Yeah. Well, as I said, there is an important verse, and of course the most important verse in the Quran about hijab is the verse 31 of chapter An-Nur, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the most important reference for the hijab in the Holy Quran. وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُنَّ وَلَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ إِلَّا مَا ظَهَرَ مِنْهَا. Now, this is a lengthy verse, of course.
Yes.
Now, I would like to read the translation. And tell the faithful woman to cast down their looks. يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُنَّ. And they should guard their private guards. وَلَا يُبْدِينَ زِينَتَهُنَّ. And they should not show their ornaments and their charms, their mm-hmm. beautification and so on.
They should not be ostentatious or showy.
Yeah, showy, of course. And, of course... Illa ma dhahara minha, beyond what is acceptably visible, because there are some parts of the women's body which mm-hmm. are visible, and they mm-hmm. cannot cover them because
yes.
they have to live in the society. They should move and interact with other people,
like the face that you said.
Sure. And then let them draw their scarves over their bosoms, وَلِيَضْرِبْنَ بِخُمُورِهِنَّ عَلَى جُيُوبِهِنَّ. This is the most important part of the verse. Let them draw their scarves over their bosoms. And this means that the scarf at least is a must. And when the scarf, when a woman is wears a scarf, that the scarf should be long enough to cover the woman's bosom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's very
important.
In other
words, the chest area.
The chest area,
or the breast area.
And this is one. This is one of the verses in the Quran. Of course, there are numerous traditions about hijab, based on which the scholars, the ulama, the religious authorities have derived and deduced Islamic laws. And given their fatwa.
Uh-huh, I see. We have a very, very short time till the end of this program or this episode of Islamic Laws. Sheikh Jawad, would you be kind enough actually to talk about the special way or method that hijab should be observed according to the Islamic dress code? Because you also mentioned that in the other religions, they also have some kind of dress code, whether they practice it today or not, that's another story, right?
Yeah, sure.
So would you?
Yeah, of course. A woman must cover her head, hair, and body, as we said, except for the face, hands, from the gaze of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about strangers, we are not talking about, about close relatives. They are not strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Those men that are marriageable, they are called strangers according to Islamic Sharia.
Right.
And another word for strangers is, non-mahram men. So men, a woman should cover these parts of her body from a non-mahram man or from non-mahram people. And of course, she must not show her adornments and her makeup, her beautification, her ornaments. For example, if she's wearing gold bangles or bracelets or rings, gold rings, these are ornaments.
Yes.
And these are things that must be covered by the woman. The same is the case with the makeup. If she's wearing makeup, if she's wearing, for example, eyelash extension.
Right.
These are beautifications. These are adornments,
mm-hmm.
and these are things that, of course, must be covered. So there is not a special method. Okay.
Right.
Every nation, every culture might have its own method of hijab, its own modest clothing.
Yes.
Of course, Iranians have their own chador, their veils, and Indians have their own.
Lebanese have their dough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Lebanese have their own bushiers, and they call it bushia, I suppose. And that's, even they cover their faces.
Right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Jawad. And thank you for listening to this program of Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me and the rest of the crew. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked. The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. We humans are all the servants of Allah. Being servant here means that we humans are the creatures of Allah, and at every moment we are learning from Allah. As Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, I am the servant of the best servant of Allah, Prophet Muhammad. Therefore, Allah is both our creator and our master, and we must obey him. Now, our duty is to respect our master and our teachers. The least effect of being in servitude to Allah is to be only His servant and not be the servant of others. In other words, if we obey Allah, we are in no need to obey others. As Hafez stated, a true spiritual wayfarer who knows the right path, he will never knock the door of others except Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A special meeting has been held by the UN titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counter-Terrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional contexts.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the UN, Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people, we stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice." But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, yeah, not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life. The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. said, "Given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith." He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S. The MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012 respectively, of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists had been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested. It added that 9 nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the U.S. and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the U.S.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot, a blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other, more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jandallah terrorist group led by Abdul Malik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziyya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. but their plots to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out two ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack Western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in three stages: before, during, and after the unrests. The CIA is referred to in the joint statement as the main culprit for inciting the riots. But the CIA is aided by Israel's Mossad and Saudi Foreign Intelligence Services, with the help of the most vicious of terrorist groups. Inciting despair among the Iranian population with the help of the massive amounts of funding that is given to foreign Farsi-speaking media outlets is listed among the primary tactics used to incite the unrests. Teaching effective escalation tactics during unrests have also been documented as another tactic used by these spy agencies. But among the many other items listed, none of them would be possible without the massive funding that the US, UK, Israel, and their Saudi allies give to the media outlets and individuals who capitalize on people's emotions. Also, supposedly international platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter freely violate their own rules in this particular case and allow posts that incite violence to be freely uploaded onto their platforms. An extra $53 million have also been allocated by the CIA to give to these Farsi-speaking media outlets and individuals on top of their annual payments. Israeli influence, however, should not be ignored. Just recently, the IRGC dismantled a network of Mossad-affiliated terrorists in West Azerbaijan province. The investment of these spy agencies in inciting unrest in Iran has been proven time and time again, and cannot possibly fit into a short clip. Rest assured, you will hear about more evidence of foreign meddling in Iran's recent riots in the days and weeks to come.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal: pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saidi Ravani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran. and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia